There's an inherent dandyism in cycling. A desire to reflect the elegance of a bike in the apparel of the rider. And most cyclists are slim, so they can wear clothes well. The clothes worn by cyclists were notable at the dawn of the cycling age, and they are notable again today. But in the mid-period of cycling, which was the mid-20th century, the clothes were not so significant. That was the time of utility cycling. People were not into cycling. They just cycled en masse. And most people rode in the clothes they would have walked in. In early 1960s Yorkshire, my dad cycled to work in his suit, and his wardrobe smelt, not unpleasantly, I thought, of stale sweat and tobacco. His one item of specialist cycling wear was an enormous yellow cape that enveloped him and the entire upper half of the bike like some great tablecloth, and on very wet days a puddle would form where it sagged over crossbar and handlebars. My mother simply didn't cycle in the rain. She had no special cycling wear, but the back wheel of her bike was partly guarded by a cloth cover to keep her skirt out of the spokes. Now let us go further back in time. Here is Mr. Hoopdriver, the working class hero of H.G. Wells's cycling novel of 1895, The Wheels of Chance. He cuts a lonely-looking little figure in a dusty brown suit and heather mixture stockings and brown shoes not meant to be cycled in. In the illustrations, we see that his trousers terminate below the knee. He is also shown to be wearing a smallish hat with a brim. Hoopdriver's adversary in the novel, the apparently more respectable but in reality caddish Béchamel, wears the short peaked cap associated with early cycling. If you see an illustration of a Victorian gent aboard a penny farthing, he's usually wearing one of those caps. And penny farthings demanded a certain dressiness, the riders being very much on show as they sailed past people's first-story drawing-room windows. The penny farthing riders were usually men, but the cycles in The Wheels of Chance were the more modern and practical safety bikes that made cycling open to women. Here is Mr. Hoopdriver encountering the attractive middle-class heroine of the novel. The young lady in grey was also riding a bicycle. She was dressed in a beautiful bluish grey, and the sun behind her drew her outline in gold and left the rest in shadow. Strange doubts possessed him as to the nature of her nether costume. A little later, he speculated what manner of girl she might be. Probably she was one of these here new women. He had a persuasion the cult had been maligned. Anyhow, she was a lady. Cycling expressed the freedom and independence of those early feminists, the new women. They cycled in what was called rational clothing, or rationals for short. The basic and revolutionary garment was a pair of knickerbockers, trouser-like things retained at the knee and named after Amelia Bloomer, an American campaigner for women's rights, who was not a cyclist, she predates the safety bike, but advocated rational clothing for women, clothes that would free them from the tyranny of full skirts, making them more mobile and active. But rationals were also complicated, and I don't recommend, if you're English, reading Americans on the subject, because Americans called trousers pants, which entangles the whole issue. Bloomers were not knickers. There was underwear beneath them. And sometimes there were skirts over the top. There were whole systems of cycling clothing for women to enable or supplement the bifurcation of the nether garments, sometimes involving, as with the rigging of a sailing boat, pulley-like ropes to draw up and divide a skirt. Here is Gwen Ravura, from her memoir of late Victorian young womanhood, Period Piece, published in 1923. Having taken up cycling, we were then promoted to wearing baggy knickerbockers under our frocks and over our white frilly drawers, We thought this horribly improper, but rather grand, and when a lady, whom I didn't like anyhow, asked me privately to lift up my frock so that she might see the strange garments underneath, I thought what a dirty mind she had. I only once saw a woman, not of course a lady, in real bloomers. In October 1895, Lady Harburton, that is Florence Wallace Harburton, was on a cycling tour of Surrey. She walked into the coffee room of the Hautboy Hotel, Ockham, Surrey, wearing real bloomers. Lady Harburton was, after all, co-founder of the Rational Dress Society. She was refused service in the coffee room and directed to the bar parlour. Lady Harburton complained to the Cyclists' Touring Club, who brought a prosecution against the landlady of the hotel. Giving evidence, Lady Harburton said of the bar parlour, "It smelt of spirits and all the horrors of the drinking bar." But the court found in favour of the landlady and her skirts-only policy. While giving her own evidence, she said, "It's all very well for Lady Harburton and her sort to parade up and down Regent Street in rationals, but they would be found alarming in her genteel coffee room." Most of the press was on her side, although not the left-wing Daily Chronicle. As women's everyday clothing became more rational, the scandal of their bike wear faded, and British cycling entered its most successful, but also its dowdiest period, the mid-20th century era of mass or utility cycling. The only people who cut a dash on their bikes were the road racers, foreign ones, because, as mentioned in my first essay, road racing in Britain did not really get going until the late 1950s. In 2013, Rob Penn wrote in The Guardian, "Any hint of cycle style in Britain was imported from the continent. Even the colours the Italians painted their bicycles, pearlescent white, yellow, pink, the heavenly blue of Bianchi, said to be the colour of the Queen of Italy's eyes, filled the minds of Englishmen with wonder." In 2016, Paul Smith, the fashion designer and cyclist, brought out his cycling scrapbook, which views cycling in part from a sartorial point of view. The book includes, for instance, a picture of the Italian cyclist Fausto Coppi, the dominant rider of the 1940s and 50s, on a leisure ride. The caption reads, "Holidaying on the Isle of Elba in 1957, but never letting his standards slip, Coppi gets everything. Shirt, shorts, socks, shoes, sunglasses, haircut, watch, exactly right." Paul Smith got his first racing bike in 1957 when he was 11. He became a member of the Beeston Road Cycling Club in Nottingham. Older members of the club would bring in French and Italian cycling magazines, showing Smith, who had never been abroad, a world mysterious and exotic. In that era, Smith recalls in his book, cyclists were the only sportsmen who wore sponsors' names on their kit. Cricketers and tennis players wore all white. Footballers didn't even have a club badge on their shirts. There's a raciness in a wider sense about the Italian, French or Belgian pro cyclists in Smith's book. They look like Alain Delon, with 5 o'clock shadows and a gunslinging air. These men might well have smoked while on a training run for the Tour de France. The logo on their jerseys might have proclaimed a brand of cigarettes or an alcoholic drink. The makers of an aperitif called Saint Raphael ran a cycling team, and the name of the current-day manufacturer of high-end cycling gear, Rafa, is derived from Saint Raphael. Rafa is the favourite brand of the Mamels, middle-aged men in Lycra. Rafa cycling jerseys always have a logo on the back to confirm to people like me that the person who's just overtaken them is not only faster but also richer, because Rafa jerseys tend to be about £120. Rafa garments, like all serious cycling gear, have properties not normally associated with mere clothes. They are antibacterial and odour-resistant, technical, or even highly technical. The key word is wicking. A merino wool cycling jersey will wick, i.e. transmit, the sweat away from your body. Merino wool, with its thermal properties, is cool on scorching hot colds in July, warm on freezing descents in January. The purchase of any item of cycling clothes seems to demand another purchase. If you buy a base layer, for instance, you need something to wear on top of it, otherwise it's not a base layer. There is winter gear and summer gear, race wear and training wear. But one thing you don't need is underpants, or, I think, knickers. You go commando under your cycling shorts, so that the chamois pad can do its protective work directly. Accordingly, I can see more of the mammal anatomy than I would like. And I can't resist quoting Jeremy Clarkson. Don't wear lycra unless you're Kate Moss. Cyclists' desire to dress like pro racers is generally traced back to 2012, when our cyclists won 8 golds at the London Olympics and Bradley Wiggins won the Tour de France. London is now, according to Rob Penn, the centre of global cycling style. The mammal look is dominant, but there are others. Those artful dodgers, the bike couriers, or cyclists who adopt that style, rock an urchin look, symbolising their outsider status. Caps with peak tipped up like Norman Wisdom, slacker shorts, a tight but not technical top to emphasise apparent malnourishment. They really are artful, though. It's not easy to maintain a shoulder bag at the 45-degree angle they favour. Mine always swings round to the front. Boris Johnson doesn't cycle in lycra, thank God. And when he was Mayor of London, he spoke of the need to de-lycrify cycling. I read of this in an article by Jack Thurston on the Cycling UK website about the Tweed Run, which, pre-pandemic, was a regular London event for fogyish cyclists. Tweed might not be everyone's idea of normal clothing, but it's a lot more normal than lycra, Thurston wrote. On the Tweed Run, apparently, there was not a helmet to be seen. According to the proprietor of my local bike shop, helmets caught on in the late 80s because they were worn by the American racing cyclist Greg LeMond, a clean-cut and clean, he was very vocal against doping, generally sensible rider. Helmets have been compulsory in pro riding since 2003, so if you want to look like a pro, you wear one. I think cycling helmets look ridiculous, like wearing half a watermelon on your head. I usually wear one, nonetheless. There's a good deal of vanity among cyclists, and I don't want it said I was killed by it.